Otis, my baby brother. Anton took out a gun. "Brace yourself," he said, pressing it into the back of my head, "because now you will join them." I prayed that he would hurry up, then I prayed that Malama would have a good life without me, then I prayed for the souls of my family. But still, the shot did not come. I opened my eyes. Anton was leering down with sadistic enjoyment. "Perhaps I will not kill you yet," he sneered. "No one knows you are still alive, so no one will seek you. I will keep you for a few more nights, until I get bored of you." I froze at his words. The thought of going back to that room was abhorrent. "Please, if you have any mercy, please shoot me," I begged, but that made him laugh. "I like to hear you beg," he said. "Tonight I will make you beg some more." He yanked me up by the hair and bundled me outside. I thought of screaming for help from the two guards sweeping the yard, but Anton clapped a filthy hand across my mouth. I don't think they knew who I was. I was stunned, incapable of action. And then we were back on Anton's horse and galloping across town to the hovel, and I sank into a state of utter hopelessness. No one knew I was there, apart from Anton and his two acolytes. Did Yurovsky think I was free? Is that why he slaughtered my family? Was he looking for me even now? That night was worse than before, as Anton violated me in different ways, forcing himself into my mouth, biting my breasts and thighs, and hurting me in every manner he could think of. I could hear the other two men next door, and knew they must hear my cries, but neither of them intervened. I was utterly alone. Anton fell asleep at last and began to snore. I lay awake, every part of me in pain. I could not get the smell of blood out of my nostrils. It was caked in my hair, on my skin. The blood of my loved ones. Oh God, may no one else ever have to experience that. The door to the room opened slowly, and one of the men beckoned me to come. At first I thought he planned to violate me too, but he put a finger to his lips and opened the door to the street outside. I staggered to the opening, grabbing what clothes I could, my legs barely able to support my weight. "You do not deserve this. Take a horse. Run," he whispered. "What is your name?" I asked him, but he wouldn't tell me. So I untied a horse and climbed on its back, and I rode east towards the dawn. Chapter 64. Brno, Czech Republic, the 16th of October, 2016. Kitty sat in silence while Hannah was reading, feeling the horror of the words written almost a century ago. Goosebumps pricked her flesh. Hannah stopped and fetched some beers from the fridge, flipped open the tops, and poured them into glasses. "My father found Tatiana the day she escaped. He said she was raving like a madwoman and trying to hang herself from a tree, but the rope kept slipping. When she told him she was a Romanov Grand Duchess, he thought she was delusional. It was only when she showed him the jewels hidden in the seams of her undergarments that he began to believe her. He took her back to his tent and fed her some broth, then persuaded her to rest a few hours while he decided what to do." Kitty tried to imagine Tatiana's state of mind. She must have been in profound shock, but somehow this man had won her trust. "Your father was clearly a good person," she said. "The very best. They don't often come like him." Hannah smiled proudly. "Papa was a member of the Czech Legion fighting the Bolsheviks, but he took time away from the front line to nurse Tatiana. He told me he knew that if he left her for so much as an hour, she would have found a way to kill herself. She couldn't bear to be alive anymore, knowing what had happened to her family." "Didn't she want to find Dmitri?" Hannah tilted her head and nodded thoughtfully. "Sometimes she tore her hair with yearning for him, then at other times she said she would die of shame if he found out what had happened to her. There were moments when she blamed him, saying if he hadn't rescued her, the rest of her family might still be alive. But then she would change her mind and cry out for him. As soon as the Czech Legion reached Yekaterinburg, Papa made inquiries, but was told Dmitri had left town and no one knew how to reach him." "So your father kept Tatiana with him?" "Of course. The Bolsheviks would have stopped at nothing to kill her, had they realized she was still alive. She maintained she wanted to die, and Papa had to coax her to eat. At night, she woke screaming from terrible nightmares of men slashing at her with bayonets. Hannah got up to check on the casserole bubbling in the oven, and there was a blast of hot air, then a fragrant meaty smell as she lifted the lid and stirred it. To be honest, I don't know how he managed. He says they followed along behind the front line, and he kept Tatiana out of sight, because once her face healed from the wounds that guard had inflicted, she would have been recognizable to any Russian civilian. Hannah took out some gaudily patterned red and purple plates and heaped spoonfuls of casserole onto each, then added slices of what looked like spongy white bread before passing one to Kitty. "Goulash with dumplings?" she said. "A local speciality." Kitty inhaled the scent of paprika and garlic, and her stomach rumbled. "How did they get back to the Czech Republic?" she asked, before taking a forkful. It was delicious, the goulash rich and flavorful, the texture of the dumplings soft and gooey. Hannah started her own meal. The Czech Republic didn't exist back then. When a declaration was made in October 1918 that the Czechs and Slovaks could form an independent republic from the old kingdoms of Bohemia and Moravia, the legionnaires were overjoyed. It's what they had long campaigned for. The civil war was not going well for the White Army, and my father persuaded Tatiana to come back here with him, just until the Bolsheviks were defeated. Of course, everyone thought their downfall was imminent, that communism was a passing phase people would get sick of. Who could have guessed it would last the rest of the century? Kitty watched her, wondering what it had been like to live under communism in Czechoslovakia. That era had only ended in 1989, when student protests brought about democratic elections. Hannah did not remotely match her mental image of an Eastern European of the communist era. She had a matronly figure, but she was smartly dressed in a grey skirt and pale pink blouse, and she wore a pearl necklace and matching pearl stud earrings. She probably had to dress smartly for her job. There was no sign of a husband or children in the house, and she wore no rings on her fingers. Kitty was curious, but didn't like to ask about her marital status. Instead, she asked when her father had told her about Tatiana. "He told me gradually over the years. I always knew he had been married to someone before my mum, and bit by bit, the rest came out." "Did you never consider telling the story publicly? To the press, I mean?" Hannah shook her head emphatically. "Why would I want to bring a media circus down on my head? What purpose would it serve?" Kitty considered. "Maybe the truth should be told for the sake of historical record, if nothing else. And your father's role is so heroic that I would have thought you would want it to be acknowledged." Hannah smiled. No one who knew my father was in any doubt about his heroism. "He needs no more accolades than those he received in his lifetime. But this is your story too, so I suppose if you want to publicize it, that is your prerogative. I would rather not be identified, but otherwise you can reveal what you like. I will let you have copies of some photographs, if that would help." After they'd finished eating, Hannah cleared the table and brought out a worn photograph album. The first picture in the book showed a group of men in military greatcoats and hats against a snowy landscape. "That's my father on the left," she said. "He was taller than the others, very clean-cut and handsome." The next pictures showed a farm, and in one there was a silhouette of a woman hoeing in a field. "That's Tatiana." Kitty peered hard, but could make out nothing except that she was willowy thin. The following photo showed some kind of village party, with flags in the street. Then Kitty turned the page, and there was a woman looking down at a baby with utter adoration, in a classic Madonna and child pose. Kitty raised her eyes in question. "That's Tatiana with her son, Yaroslav, my half-brother. He was born in 1922, 3 years after they arrived in the Czech Republic. By then, she had married my father and taken the name Irena to protect her identity." "Of course, Irena Markova, the translator of Dmitri's books, and Grand Duchess Tatiana were one and the same person." Kitty had realized there was a connection, but hadn't made that final step. So she had come to Albany to be with him. Even wearing the clothes of a farmer's wife, with a scarf tied round her hair, Tatiana was recognizable as the second daughter of Tsar Nicholas. The fine bone structure, the intelligent eyes, the distant, self-contained air. Of course it was her. "What happened to Yaroslav? Is he still around?" If he was, he would be the direct heir to the Romanov dynasty. No, he died in 1943. It was awful. I don't think either Tatiana or my father ever recovered. Kitty flicked through pages of photographs of the boy at different stages of his life. A toddler, a schoolboy, a handsome teenager. While Hannah told his story. Yaroslav was always a headstrong boy. He had been brought up to hate repression. So when the Nazis marched into our country in 1939, he joined the partisan guerrilla group that sabotaged supply chains and helped to smuggle Jews out of the country. For 4 years he dodged capture, but all the time his parents lived with their hearts in their mouths. And then, in 1943, his luck ran out. He was arrested, probably tortured, and executed. Hannah sounded emotional, recalling the death of the half-brother she never knew. I can't begin to imagine how Tatiana survived that period. It's unthinkable for one person to lose so much. Kitty paused over a photograph of a simple grave with a tiny vase of flowers beside it, and a headstone carved with the boy's name and dates. I know she came to America with Dimitri in 1948. How did he find her? She found him. Just before the war, she came across an article about him, and she was astonished because she had been told he died in 1919. She showed it to my father, and he says he knew from that moment that she would leave him one day. Hannah rose to clear their plates. They had been good companions for each other, and she was grateful to him for protecting her, but she never loved him the all-consuming way she loved Dimitri. Of course, the war intervened, and then she was in deep mourning for Yaroslav's death. But one day, in 1948, after they'd brought in the harvest, she told my father that it was time for her to leave. She thanked him for all he had done for her, and wished him the very best. It broke his heart, but he didn't try to stop her. He knew she was going to Dimitri. Kitty felt sorry for Vaclav. It seemed a shame after all he had done for Tatiana. Did she not keep in touch? I think there were occasional letters. I don't have copies of them. My father met my mother a few months later, and I was born in 1949, so he didn't hang around for long. Did he divorce Tatiana? I believe he had the marriage dissolved, because he married my mother when I was 3. I got to be a bridesmaid at their wedding. As you can imagine, this was considered shocking back in the 1950s. She laughed and rolled her eyes. I'm glad he had another family. He deserved to be happy. We were. The 3 of us had a good life. I hope Tatiana found happiness too. Kitty wondered about that. She knew little about Dimitri's life in America, never mind his time with Irena. I hope so too, but I wonder about the body found near his cabin. If it is her, and he was not responsible for the death, which sounds unlikely given how much they loved each other, then why would he not report it to the authorities in the normal way? She guessed the answer as she spoke, but it was Hannah who said it out loud. Do you remember the furore over the bones of Romanov impostors? Anna Tchaikovsky's remains were exhumed for further DNA tests several years after she died. I imagine he didn't want that for Tatiana. It's a shame it is happening now. Kitty was quiet. Hannah had said the decision about whether to expose the truth was in her hands. Did she want them testing these bones? Or should she ask that they be buried in her great-grandfather's grave, and let the 2 of them rest in peace? It was a tricky decision. The next morning, a friend of Hannah's, a woman called Erica, who looked roughly the same age, came to take them out in her car. When she arrived, she kissed Hannah on the lips, and Kitty realized they were lovers, although they did not announce it. Erica drove them out to the karst lands, and they caught a cable car over lush, forested slopes down into a spectacular gorge with a river splashing through. They toured a collapsed cavern known as the Machoka Abyss, then some caves with elaborate stalactites and stalagmites, like spooky pointing fingers. There was a sense of ancient history that went back millions of years, long before the existence of man, and Kitty loved the otherworldly atmosphere. As they walked around the footpaths of the gorge, they talked a little more about Tatiana and Dimitri, and Kitty realized Erica knew the story. I admire the fact that she was able to adapt to being a farmer's wife after an upbringing of such wealth and grandeur, Erica said. Hannah tells me she did the heaviest farm work without complaint. Did she never consider trying to reclaim any of the Romanov fortune? Kitty asked.
Oh, no, Hannah replied. Once, when they had financial difficulties, Vaclav travelled to Prague to sell some jewels she had smuggled out of Russia, and so many questions were asked that he ran away. In the end, he sold them to a black marketeer, who did not question their provenance. But he probably got far less than they were worth.
She said she never wanted to be a royal, Erica added. She liked a simple life.
And your father? Didn't he want to be rich? Kitty asked Hannah.
Never. Money had no importance for him.
Hannah laughed. He was a wise man.
Do you think the story would be worth a lot of money now?
Erica asked Kitty.
Probably, she agreed. But Hannah and I have been discussing it, and I'm not sure either of us wants to be in the media spotlight.
But you are a journalist, are you not?
Erica asked. Kitty liked these honest, down-to-earth women, and in answer to their question, she told them about her decision to change career and work as a carpenter. There are plenty of journalists in the world, talented writers with drive and ambition, and I'm just not one of them. But I'm proud of the work I did on Dimitri's cabin this summer. She finished. If you ever want to borrow it for a holiday, you'd be more than welcome.
What a lovely idea.
Hannah put her arm round Erica and gave her a squeeze.
Chapter 65 Lake Akanadi, New York State, December 1968. Dmitri and Tatiana chuckled when they read in December 1968 of the marriage of Anna Tchaikovsky, the woman who claimed to be Grand Duchess Anastasia, to an American genealogist called Jack Manahan, who was 20 years her junior. She had made an entire career of her claims and had many influential supporters, although she had never been accepted by the living Romanov family members. Now Jack Manahan announced himself as the new Grand Duke-in-waiting from their home in Virginia, a claim met with scorn by the Romanovs.
"Don't you want to go and visit your sister now that she is in America?" Dmitri teased.
"Goodness, whatever for? She looks nothing like Anastasia, and she sounds rather a disturbed creature."
"No one would believe us if we announced that you are Grand Duchess Tatiana. It would be very hard to prove, although to me you look the same as the first day I set eyes on you."
Tatiana had celebrated her 70th birthday the previous year. She was still slender, with glorious cheekbones and the same intelligent grey eyes ringed with violet she'd had as a girl. She was careful to wear a straw hat to keep the sun off her pale skin, and was not nearly as lined as Dmitri. At the age of 77, his cheeks hung in folds, and his forehead was scored by deep furrows. Tatiana leaned over to trace his wrinkles and frown lines with a finger.
"I think I have been the cause of most of these," she smiled. "We didn't choose the easiest paths in life."
"Do you ever think about leaving a record of the truth for future historians to find long after we are gone?" Dmitri asked. "I would like my children to understand why I was unfaithful to their mother, even if they don't forgive me."
"You can write it if you like. I don't care what is said when I am gone."
"Why don't we write it together?" Dmitri suggested. "Starting from 1914, when you floated like an angel into the hospital ward where I lay with my wounded leg, and we talked about dogs and then books.
There are so many horrendous memories that would have to be included alongside the beautiful ones. I fear it might upset us to revisit them."
"It's all such a long time ago," Dmitri said. "I think I can cope if you can."
And so they began reconstructing their joint story. Dmitri wrote the first draft in Russian. He still couldn't express himself as poetically as he wished in English. Then Tatiana translated it, adding in her own perspectives. He knew most of her story already. She had even confided in him about the horrors she had endured at the hands of Anton. But now they looked back, they could see how quirks of fate had played with them. If only one of the many attempts to rescue the Romanovs had been successful, he and she could have led a life together in exile. They could have had children together. If Alexei hadn't been ill in April 1918, and Vasily Yakovlev had managed to get them to Omsk, or if Armistead had arrived on the 13th of July 1918 and spirited them away. These things didn't bear thinking about. There was no purpose in regret. They realized they had missed each other by days after the murder of her family. When the Czechs entered Yekaterinburg in late July, and Vaclav tried to find Dmitri, he was away in Verkhoturye, hunting for the Romanovs. If only Vaclav had gone to see Sir Thomas Preston, the British ambassador, he would have told him.
I should have suggested that, Tatiana sighed. I wasn't thinking clearly.
When she received the letter from Dmitri's mother saying he had died at Tsaritsyn in 1919, she should have stayed in touch, or asked to be put in contact with his sisters. Then they could have been reunited the following year when he arrived in Constantinople. All that time we wasted, Dmitri mused. And yet we have each other now, and somehow this is enough happiness for one lifetime.
Let's not pretend that you weren't happy with Rosa, too,
Tatiana smiled.
I regret I never met her. She was a remarkable woman.
And Vaclav was a hero. I'm still amazed that he took such good care of you and asked nothing in return.
It's true. He was a gentleman who never tried to come into my bed until I invited him. We were both lucky in the people who rescued us, although I'm not sure they were quite so lucky.
Both Rosa and Vaclav featured in the book they wrote together. Chapter by chapter they drafted, translated and polished, reading and commenting on each other's work. It got to the stage that when Dmitri reread it and found a phrase he admired, he could no longer remember whether it was his or Tatiana's, so intertwined were their words. They spent all summer at the cabin, and came at weekends in winter too, but they repaired to Tatiana's Albany house during the height of bug season in May and June, and during the coldest weather, when the lake was frozen and the damp ate into Dmitri's elderly bones, making his leg injuries ache more than 50 years after they were inflicted. They transported their typewriter and the growing stack of pages to and fro in Dmitri's new Pontiac motor car, which had room in the back for Trina, the Borzoi.
Where should we end our story?
Tatiana asked one day.
I think it should stop with me finding you at the Café Slavia in Prague.
But then it will not answer my children's questions, Dmitri mused.
I want them to understand that there was never any question of me leaving their mother, and that you agreed. I want them to know how sorry I am about the way they found out about you, and how much I miss being part of their lives. Marta might not like you writing for publication that she is no longer communicating with you, Tatiana said. It paints her in a bad light.
Dmitri pondered that.
Why don't I send both her and Nicholas a copy of the manuscript, saying that I'll be happy to cut anything they don't want published? I hope they will be tempted to read it, knowing it concerns their lives.
They agreed on this plan, and had 2 Xerox copies made. One was posted to Nicholas in California, and Dmitri drove to Marta's house in Albany to deliver the other, only to have the door answered by a stranger.
They moved to England years ago now, the woman said. I had a forwarding address, but I think they've moved on.
Dmitri called Nicholas's house in California and spoke to Patty, who told him that Marta and Stanley lived in a suburb of London, where he sold insurance since the cutlery company had gone bankrupt. She gave him the new address.
How old is my grandchild now?
He asked.
Elizabeth is 9. Marta absolutely dotes on her.
I thought she'd be older. Didn't Marta get pregnant soon after Rosa died in 1955?
She did, but she lost that baby, and several more before Elizabeth was born. It's not been easy for her.
I'm so sad to hear that, Dmitri sighed. If only she had turned to him, but he was the last person she would have wanted to talk to.
How is Nicholas?
He asked. Has he read my book?
There was a long pause.
I'm afraid that Nicholas and I are separated. I had to kick him out when his alcoholism got out of control. He lives in an apartment near the beach, so I took your parcel to him, but I doubt he's read it.
I'm so sorry.
Dmitri was stricken.
I wish I had known. Is there anything I can do? I could pay for him to go to a clinic.
I tried that, but he won't go. He's not interested in stopping. I know he loves me, and I love him too. I've told him he can come home if he gives up drinking, but he simply can't do it. He manages one day, two at most, and the least little thing sends him back to the bourbon. I'm sorry, Dmitri, but I think he's beyond hope.
I'm coming out. I'll fly there next week.
Patty gave a big sigh.
I doubt it will make a difference, but you can stay here if you want to try.
Dmitri flew to Santa Barbara in March 1970 and was met at the airport by his daughter-in-law. She drove him to Nicholas's apartment in a run-down block with some rusty old motorcycles out front. He knocked on the door, but when Nicholas opened it and saw his father, he slammed it shut again. All Dmitri noticed was that he had long, straggly hair and an unkempt beard. It was difficult with his arthritic joints, but Dmitri slid down to sit on the floor in the corridor outside and called through the door.
I used to drink too much, Nicholas. Way too much. It was your mother who saved me. First of all by motivating me to write novels, and then by giving me children and forcing me to look to the future. Patty is a good woman. Please let her help you, the way your mum helped me.
He waited, but there was no sound from within. He wasn't sure if Nicholas was listening.
I miss your mother every day. I'm sure you do too. But imagine what she would say if she could see you now, son. Try to pull yourself together for her sake.
No reply. He sat there for hours, calling through the door. He'd come all this way, and there was no point in giving up, although he supposed he would have to go back to Patty's at nightfall. He was too old to spend the night outside. Suddenly, the door opened, and Nicholas glared at him.
Will you not leave me in peace?
He asked, bleary-eyed and exhausted-looking.
I don't care about your book, or Tatiana, or any of it. Publish what you want. You don't need my approval.
He was shoeless, his shirt hanging open, and he smelled rank, as if he hadn't bathed for a long time. Worse than that was his nose. It was bulbous and red, etched with purple spider veins, a true drinker's nose. Dmitri remembered such noses on the men back in Russia who drank vast quantities of homemade vodka and usually died young after passing out in the snow or choking on their own vomit.
Son, you're ill. Please let me take you to a doctor.
It's too late, Dad. You can't wave your money around and make this go away. Unfortunately, I inherited the melancholy gene from you rather than the happy gene from Mom, and I don't want to go through life like this. The drink is merely a means to an end.
Dmitri protested.
You're only 44 years old. Your whole life is in front of you. You can do anything you want, anything.
Good, because what I want is to drink myself to death.
He tried to close the door, but Dmitri stuck his arm in the way.
Come for a drink with me, then. Let me buy you a beer at your local bar.
Nicholas shrugged and agreed to that. He slid his feet into some battered beach shoes, but didn't bother to fasten his shirt or comb his hair. Dmitri's joints were aching from sitting on the ground, and he limped heavily as they walked down the road to a dingy bar with a Budweiser sign out front. Dmitri ordered two beers and let Nicholas have a bourbon chaser. Then they sat in a booth and talked man to man for the first time in their lives.
I never thought you were really there, Dad, Nicholas told him. Your head was always somewhere else. I certainly never got the feeling that you loved Marta and me. We were an irritation to you, a duty. I suppose when I found out you'd had another woman all that time, it finally made sense. Oh, that's why he was like that. It wasn't because of me. In a way, it was comforting. I know Marta was furious for what you did to Mom, but I don't have any anger. I just feel like you're a stranger.
While he spoke, tears rolled down Dmitri's cheek. He took out a handkerchief and dabbed at them.
I know I failed as a father. I always hoped you'd turn out fine because you had such a wonderful mother, but maybe you needed me too.
I don't know what caused this thing I have, alcoholism, depression, call it what you will. I'm not sure it would have been any different if you'd been the perfect parent. There's no use you blaming yourself. I've screwed up all by myself.
What can be done to make you want to live?
Dmitri asked.
Nothing, Nicholas said firmly.
Some things are unfixable.
Will you not try? If I find the name of the top expert in California and pay for a consultation, will you at least see him? Maybe there's a pill you can take, or electric shock therapy, or surgery. I climbed out of the kind of morass you were in, so I know it's possible. Please try, son.
At last, Nicholas agreed. With Patty's help, Dimitri found an expert and paid for a course of detoxification treatment. He left feeling optimistic, but when he telephoned on his return to Albany, Patty told him that Nicholas had not even attended the first appointment. There was more bad news. 2 weeks after his return, a lawyer's letter arrived from England saying that Marta would sue him for defamation if he published the book.
"That's that, then," he told Tatiana. "We'll have to forget it." "Why don't you talk to Alfred?" she suggested. "When are you next seeing him?"
Dimitri still had occasional lunches with Alfred A. Knopf in New York City. His company had merged with Random House, and he had semi-retired, but he still dabbled in editorial matters and kept in touch with his favourite authors. When Dimitri met him that spring at Barbetta, their usual Italian restaurant, he mused that his publisher had barely changed from the day they had first met. The moustache and hair were white rather than jet black, and his waist was a little thicker, but the lively eyes and the gregarious character were unchanged. Dimitri handed over the manuscript.
"Prepare to be surprised when you read it," he said. "I don't want an advance, but my only stipulation is that it mustn't be published in my children's lifetimes. Marta might live another 50 years, so perhaps it could be penciled for publication in 2020. Is it possible to arrange that?"
"It's out of the ordinary, but I don't see why not. I could leave it in the archives flagged with a note for someone to revisit it in 2020.
A week later, he telephoned, having read the manuscript.
"Are you kidding me? We've been friends for 35 years and you never told me you're married to one of the goddamn Romanov royal family? Well, I'll be damned. Is there no chance I can persuade you to publish now? I'm sure our lawyers could see off your daughter's objections."
"No, I don't want to upset her any more than I have already. But thanks, Alfred."
He wrote to Nicholas and Marta, telling them both he had decided not to publish, and was pleased to receive a postcard from Nicholas. It had a picture on the front of some kids playing volleyball on a beach, and it read, "Thanks for coming over to see me, Dad." That was all, but it was nice. 6 months later, Nicholas died of cirrhosis of the liver. Patty wrote to tell Dimitri, since there was no phone at the cabin, and she'd been unable to reach him at the house in Albany. At last, his boy was at peace, after a tortured life. Dimitri flew to California for the funeral, hoping that Marta might be there, and that he'd have a chance to talk with her. Perhaps there could still be a rapprochement at this sad time. His hopes were dashed when she didn't show up.
"Since Rosa died, Marta has never been able to deal with anything emotionally challenging," Patty told him. "She pulls down the shutters and pretends nothing is wrong. I'm sorry to say it, but I don't think she'll ever change."
"Is she happy?" Dimitri asked.
Patty shrugged.
"I don't think her marriage is perfect. She once told me that Stanley has a wandering eye. I guess that makes it even harder for her to forgive you. But she adores her daughter. Elizabeth is the center of her life."
When he got back to Albany, Dimitri rewrote his will, leaving enough for Tatiana, should she outlive him, and the remainder of his estate to whichever of his descendants came forward to claim it. Perhaps his little granddaughter would come to find him one day. He surely hoped so. Chapter 66. Lake Aconabee, New York State, February 1975. Dimitri celebrated his 80th birthday at the cabin with Tatiana. She made his favourite Russian pashka, a dessert similar to the American's cheesecake, and stuck a candle in the top that dripped wax down the side while he struggled to find the breath to blow it out. They lived very simply now, eating vegetables she had grown in the garden around the cabin, and the occasional fish he caught from the end of the dock, although in truth he never had much patience for fishing. They still commuted between there and the Albany cottage, but spent most of their time at the lake, keeping the stove stocked with firewood on the cold days and talking, always talking. They joked that if they were to live another 20 years, they would never run out of conversation. They discussed religion and philosophy, and tried to agree upon the ideal political system. They fretted over news reports of the Vietnam War, worried about whether America was right to get involved. They talked about books and music, and remembered theatrical productions they had seen back in St. Petersburg before the First World War. They talked about people they had known, and they speculated on what Tatiana's brother and sisters might have been like had they lived. Each expressed whatever was on his or her mind at the moment, and it flowed back and forth in a fast-moving current of companionship. If they woke at night when the wind blew hard outside and rain hammered on the cabin's tin roof, they resumed the conversation they'd been having earlier. In his head, Dmitri sometimes compared the two women he had loved. Sex had never been especially important in his relationship with Tatiana. Rosa had been much more enthusiastic in that department, and she had brought him great pleasure with her skills. There had never been the meeting of the minds he had with Tatiana, though. When you were in your 80s, that became most important. To feel that another human being truly understood the core of you and loved what they saw, while you felt the same about them. That was the best feeling of all. In some ways, he thought, it was the highest achievement of humanity. He had failed in all his other close relationships, but at least he got the most important one right. One spring day, he drove to the store in Indian Lake, slowly, peering through the windshield because his glasses were not strong enough and the road appeared as a blur. He bought a few items, then on the way back remembered he had forgotten tea, the one thing Tatiana had expressly asked for, so he turned round to get some. When he drove down the track and the cabin came into view, he saw Tatiana lying on the soil, and his first thought was that she must have lost an earring. Trina was sitting nearby, whining. He got out of the car and hobbled towards Tatiana. ''Angel?'' he called. ''Is everything okay?'' When she didn't reply, he limped across and sank to his knees, turning her onto her back. She wasn't breathing. Gulping back a sob, he put an ear to her chest, but couldn't hear a heartbeat. He had never given artificial respiration, but he'd read about it in a magazine, so he tried frantically pressing down on her chest and blowing into her mouth. All the time he knew, deep inside, that she had gone. He was simply delaying the moment when he must accept it. The expression on her face was calm. At least she had not felt any pain. When he had tried to revive her for several minutes without getting any response, Dmitri gathered her in his arms and howled, the sound echoing across the lake. He howled again and again. "Don't go, Tatiana. Don't go. Come back, don't do this to me." He cried out loud, tears spilling as he rocked her back and forwards, trying to shake her out of death's grip. The pain was so appalling he thought he must be dying too, and he looked up at the sky and prayed that God would take him now. "You don't understand. I can't be without her. I can't survive." A light rain began to fall. But still Dmitri sat there, holding her, stroking her hair, kissing her cold lips, squeezing her to see if there was 1 ounce of life left. "Can you still hear me, darling? If you can, please try to come back. Oh, you must come back to me. I can't bear it." Her face was changing, tightening in death. The lips were pale and thin, her cheeks alabaster. Dmitri knew he should call the police. They would come and take her away to an undertaker's. Perhaps there would be an autopsy to establish the cause of death. What did that matter to him? She was gone, and he would never find her again if he searched the world over. "I'll keep her with me a little longer," he thought. "Just a while." The sun had started to lower in the skies when he decided that he did not want anyone to take her away. Not ever. He would keep her with him at the cabin. No one need know. He would have to work fast because he couldn't risk someone coming by and finding them like this. He lifted her head off his lap and rose with great difficulty, his hips and knees locked in place from sitting too long. Trina followed as he staggered to the cabin for his tools and some planks of wood he had bought for repairing the porch. Along with a couple of wooden boxes they used for storage, there would be just enough for a makeshift coffin. He wasn't a proficient carpenter, but he managed to fashion a coffin of a size that would accommodate her. The edges were uneven, the angles askew, but it would do. He hobbled around looking for the perfect spot. Just to the west of the cabin there was a grassy bank between the silver birch trees, with a view out across the lake. The ground was malleable beneath his spade, and the moon came out as he worked. He didn't stop to eat or drink, not once, because he was scared he might collapse and be unable to finish. His back was aching, his hips and knees screeching complaint, and he was wheezing for breath in the cold night air. But he kept going, deeper and deeper. He welcomed the work because it stopped him thinking about the infinite vastness of his loss. Tatiana lay on her back, looking more beautiful than ever, the moonlight glowing on her skin, her eyes closed as though she was simply asleep. He hoped she would approve of what he was doing. Dmitri kept digging until he'd made a hole that would accommodate the coffin, and he lowered it inside. Next he lined it with a rose-coloured satin quilt, so the rough wood could not scratch her skin, and he put in a little pillow for her head. Clouds scudded across the moon, and stars twinkled, but it was utterly silent on the lake, apart from the lapping of tiny waves on the shore and Trina's snuffling. No owls hooted. No whip-poor-wills sang. He found he did not have the strength to lift Tatiana, so he slipped his hands beneath her shoulders and pulled her, legs dragging, to her resting place. As he arranged her so she was comfortable, he noticed that she was wearing Autopo's oval dog tag on a chain around her neck, with the tiny sapphire, ruby, and imperial topaz stones set within fancy swirls. On a whim, he took it off and fastened it around his own neck instead. It was April, and he had seen some wildflowers blooming in the woods. Tatiana loved flowers. She should have had magnificent roses and orchids, lilies and cherry blossom, but all he could find was some tiny pink, purple, and white flowers hidden in the grass. He picked a few handfuls and sprinkled them around her. When he was done, the sky was turning salmon pink over the eastern part of the lake as the sun nudged the horizon. It was time. He lay down and leaned into the grave to kiss her one last time, letting his lips move all over her face, her neck, her hands, in a frenzy of kisses. He could still smell her scent, and he took a deep breath, as if to preserve it within him forever. Then he wrapped the quilt round her to keep her safe and warm, and that's when the tears started. As he hammered the lid on her coffin and covered it with soil, he couldn't stop crying. Something had broken inside him, and he knew it would never be fixed.
Chapter 67. London, November 2016. When Kitty got back to London, there was an email waiting for her from the editor at Random House, New York, asking if she was able to go for a meeting with them. She replied that she was in London and unlikely to be back in the US till the spring, whereupon they asked if she could visit their London offices, which were on Vauxhall Bridge Road, just behind Tate Britain. Kitty wondered if they wanted to talk about reissuing Dmitri's novels. She hoped so. She gave her name in the glass-fronted reception area, and in no time at all, a dark-haired, bespectacled girl called Annabelle arrived to lead her upstairs to a pokey office, where she was introduced to a girl called Olivia. She had the grand title of publishing director, although Kitty thought she looked as if she was fresh out of university. "This is an unpublished manuscript of your great-grandfather's that we found in the archives," she said, indicating a stack of pages covered in an old-fashioned typewriter font. "There was a memo attached from Alfred A. Knopf, the founder of Knopf Publishing, which is part of Random House." She handed it to Kitty, who read it quickly. "To the editorial director of Non-Fiction in 2020, this is dynamite. Believe me when I tell you that you have a bestseller on your hands. My good friend Dmitri Yakovlevich wanted us to publish it, but not until after the death of his daughter, Marta, as she was opposed to publication for reasons that will become clear when you read it." He gave the last known address for Marta, and asked them to liaise with any descendants they could trace.
Publish it sensitively, he advised. You will not be able to prevent the sensationalist press having a field day, but this man is a writer of great literary merit, and I would hate for that to be lost in the furore that will undoubtedly erupt. What on earth is it? Kitty asked. I read it at the weekend, Olivia told her. It's the story of your great-grandfather and his love affair with the Russian Grand Duchess, Tatiana Romanova. It's quite astounding. Who wrote it? Kitty asked. They both did. Whoa, Kitty grinned. I had no idea they'd done that, but I'm delighted. This is a delicate question, Olivia said. But is there any way of proving it's true? There have been so many Romanov imposters over the years. Kitty showed her Autopose dog tag, with the jewels set in a pretty golden oval. This dates from the very beginning of their relationship, she said. But the only way of proving it categorically will be if we have DNA tests carried out on a skeleton that I found a few weeks ago at Dimitri's old cabin in New York State. Now that she knew Dimitri and Tatiana had wanted their story to be published one day, she would make sure it was. She would call the detective in Indian Lake to tell him of her suspicion that the body would prove to be a member of the Romanov royal family, and suggest he contact the laboratory in Stanford University that had done recent tests on the Romanov remains. Once all the legal paperwork was completed, she would rebury Tatiana's body in Dimitri's grave in the Cedar River Cemetery near Lake Akanabi. She and Tom could organize an appropriate service to mark the occasion. Might I borrow a copy of the manuscript to read?
Of course, Olivia agreed. It's your copyright, so we will need to contact you in order to publish it. If we can prove this was co-written by a Romanov Grand Duchess, we'll be able to offer a substantial advance.
Kitty started reading on her journey home. It began with Dimitri wakening from a laudanum stupor to see an angel in a white dress, with whom he fell in love almost immediately. The writing was elegant and spare. When Kitty got home, she made coffee and curled her feet beneath her on the sofa to read about their secret marriage in 1916, of Tatiana's 18 months of house arrest, and then the shocking night of their separation in July 1918. She stopped to have dinner with Tom, then returned to the sofa to read long into the night about Dimitri and Tatiana's reunion in Prague in 1948, followed by the difficult years when she was his secret mistress in Albany, and finally, the traumatic rift with his children. That explained why Kitty had never met him. She was surprised that Marta, the sweet grandmother she remembered, could have held a grudge lasting 30 years. Perhaps she avoided confrontation, like her granddaughter, and the result was that the wound was never able to heal. She felt sad that her mother had never learned the truth. Surely she would have found a way to bridge the chasm between Marta and Dimitri, and he could have died knowing he was forgiven. But Marta had told Elizabeth that her grandparents died before she was born. A lie like that, once told, can never be untold. Had Marta regretted it? Dimitri was still alive when Kitty was born. Did her grandmother consider breaking her silence then, or was she too stubborn? If only Dimitri had tried harder to heal the rift with his children. Perhaps he simply did not know how. Men of that generation did not have much practice at dealing with complex emotional situations. Perhaps he felt he was doing the right thing by respecting Marta's choice. It was such a shame. Honest communication was the only way through an emotional impasse. Kitty had learned that over the summer. Brooding never helped anyone to heal, but talking did. She had also learned that infidelity need not be the end of a relationship. Some things are more important. Tragically, Marta never learned that, and the upshot had been a lifelong estrangement. Dimitri and Tatiana's lives had been full of tragedy, and yet theirs had been such a strong love, lasting through the decades and transcending all obstacles, that you could also say they had been fortunate. Not many people find such life-affirming intimacy. Kitty's thoughts turned to Tom. What other man would have put up with her running away for 3 months? He knew her inside out, and still he was prepared to stick around, and she realized she was incredibly lucky. It must have been difficult being her partner during all those years when she clammed up and refused to talk about her parents or anything else that was upsetting her. It had taken the thunderbolt of Tom's infidelity to shake her out of her cocoon, and now she was almost glad it had happened.
She thought of Tatiana and Dmitri living in the cabin in their 70s, supporting each other as they succumbed to the ailments and indignities of old age, and continuing what they described in the book as a lifelong, never-ending conversation. Suddenly she knew she wanted to have that with Tom. She wanted to be with him when they were both in their 70s. She liked the sense of history coming around. If only there was a way of letting Dmitri know how much he had helped her. She hoped he would have been pleased.
Chapter 68. Lake Akanabi, New York State, 1986. One night in the winter of 1986, Dmitri woke with an acute pain in his chest and knew it was a heart attack.
Tatiana!
He cried, then rolled out of bed, landing with a bump on the floor. Ortipo followed, licking his face. The pain came in waves, and between them he scrabbled across the cabin floor to the door, managed to open it, and hurl himself down the steps. The chain around his neck caught on something, and the Fabergé dog tag with its sapphire, ruby, and imperial topaz jewels was ripped off. Ortipo was whining and nudging him to get up. There was no one left in his life now, no one to live for. If only Marta was nearby. If only she'd forgiven him. He thought of his daughter, so lively and popular as a teenager. Somehow he had never understood her. After Tatiana died, he had written her a heartfelt letter about his grief at their estrangement and told her of his profound loneliness. Deep down he knew he could expect no sympathy. She'd rejoice to hear about the death of the woman she considered to have been his mistress. There was no reply, and after that final attempt, he became a virtual recluse. He got rid of the Albany cottage and spent all his days in the cabin. Once a week he drove into Indian Lake to do some shopping, pick up a newspaper that he would never get around to reading, and collect his mail from the sorting office. But he dreaded it, because too often the letters told of the deaths of people he had known. His sisters Vera and Valerina lived till their late 80s, then died within a year of each other. Their funerals had already taken place by the time he picked up the letters informing him. He wrote to Vera's children, with whom he had barely kept in touch over the years, offering his belated sympathies. His dog Trina died, and he bought another Borzoi. This time he called her Ortipo, after the first dog he and Tatiana had tried and failed to train. She was a beautiful creature, with a rich copper coat and white underside, a sensitive, timid dog who shrank behind him when they met other dogs in the street and hovered close by his side when he worked around the cabin. At night, Ortipo slept on the bed next to him, helping to keep him warm. Dmitri received notification from a new editor at Random House that his books had gone out of print and he could buy the remaining stock cheaply if he wanted, but he didn't see the point. His lunches with Alfred A. Knopf petered out around 1980 when Dmitri could no longer face the long train journey into the city. Soon he had no social contacts at all, apart from the lady who worked in the grocery store and a fisherman called Bob who lived on the other side of the lake. Bob married a girl called Sue, and Dmitri gave them copies of his novels as a wedding present, because he couldn't think what else to give. Tatiana would have known. Rosa would certainly have known. He knew he was becoming forgetful. Sometimes his memories of the two women joined up, so that they were all sitting together in a glorious sunny field enjoying a picnic, and it came as a shock when he remembered that they never actually met. There were days when he awoke and called to Tatiana, as if she were outside working in the vegetable patch, and it could be several minutes before he remembered that she was no longer able to reply. A few times he thought he saw her in the woods, and that was a nice feeling. He often spoke to her out loud, asking what he should do about the rip in his shirt, or how the heck she stopped her scrambled eggs sticking to the pan, or commenting on a dark storm cloud looming over the lake. And now, in his final moments, his only thoughts were of Tatiana. It was just 15 feet to the trees by the shore, but Dmitri had no breath left. Who knew it would hurt so much? He clung to clumps of frozen grass, pulling himself along, until finally He was lying on top of the earth where his great love was buried. And he smiled, in spite of the agony, and spread his arms wide across her grave in a final embrace.
Historical afterword. I hope you've enjoyed reading The Secret Wife as much as I enjoyed writing it. The seed of the story came about in conversation with my very talented friend, Richard Hughes, who gave me the greatest gift anyone can ever give to a novelist. He had just watched a BBC Two documentary about the Russian Grand Duchesses and was intrigued by the love affair between Tatiana and an officer called Dmitri Malama. "Could this be your next novel?" he asked, and I instantly fell off my chair in excitement. I'd long been fascinated by the tragic story of the Romanovs. Back in my teens, I read Anthony Summers and Tom Mangold's book, The File on the Tsar, and desperately wanted to believe their theory that some of the family had survived. I read other books about the Romanovs as they were published, and I knew that both Olga and Tatiana had flirtations with officers they treated in the Tsarskoe Selo hospital. But I'd only come across Dmitri Malama as a footnote. Once I started reading about him and realized how handsome and courageous he was, and how close he and Tatiana seemed to have been, the plot of The Secret Wife fell into place. During my research, I discovered that Dmitri Yakovlevich Malama was born on the 19th of July, 1891, in Lozovatka, the son of a cavalry general, and he had two sisters, Vera and Valerina. He trained at the prestigious Imperial Corps de Page in St. Petersburg, which brought him into contact with the royal court. In August 1912, he graduated and became a cornet in the Uhlan Lancer Guard Regiment, of which Grand Duchess Tatiana was honorary colonel. 2 years later, during the opening week of the First World War, he was wounded in the leg while their regiment was under attack, but he refused to leave the field, earning him the Golden Arms Sword with an inscription that read, "For Bravery." Dmitri was brought to hospital in Tsarskoe Selo in September 1914, and there he got to know Tatiana, who had volunteered as a nurse. There's a chance he might have encountered her before, but now they became so close that he gave her a gift of a French bulldog she called Autopo. I slightly tinkered with the historical fact at this point. In fact, he asked her permission to buy her a puppy, and she excitedly said, "Yes," straight away, then had to write a note apologizing to her mother and asking if it would be all right. He had the puppy delivered to the palace, but as a novelist, I couldn't resist altering the facts to have him surprise her with the gift. Tatiana's 1914 diaries list what she has been doing and who she has seen without much commentary, but it is easy to read between the lines with entries such as these. 27th of September 1914. Malama took photographs. He is awfully sweet. He is already walking by himself, but of course still limping. 23rd of October 1914. Talked to Malama's sweetheart in the hallway for a little, then went to his ward and took photographs. "Today my darling Malama is being discharged from the infirmary. I feel such horrible regret." 28th of October 1914. After dinner at 9:15, Malama came over and sat till 10:15. I was terribly glad to see him. He was very sweet. 21st of November 1914. Had tea at home with Mama, we four, and Malama's sweetheart was here. Was awfully glad to see him, and we said goodbye as he is going to the front soon. If Dmitri and Tatiana corresponded while he was at the front, the letters have not survived. A year and a half later, once he had returned to Tsarskoe Selo, Alexandra wrote of him to Tsar Nicholas. "He had matured, though still a lovely boy. I have to admit, he would make an excellent son-in-law. Why are foreign princes not like him? Had it not been for the revolution, there is a good chance Malama and Tatiana could have married. Malama's family were part of Russia's old nobility, and they were precedents because Nicholas's sister, Olga, had married an army officer in 1916. Tatiana also had an admirer called Volodya, but there is no doubt Malama was her favourite from the many times she mentions him in her diaries and from the numerous photographs she took of him. In my story, I departed from known historical fact when I had them engage in a secret marriage, although there is a precedent for this in the Russian royal family. It is rumoured that Catherine the Great secretly married her lover, Grigory Potemkin, in 1774, and I have borrowed some details of the moonlit